Good morning. This is KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And this is a pre-recorded program. I'm in the studio today with Richard Fagan, and we're continuing our series of this strange and wonderful world that Richard is taking us on. Richard is a retired professor from Stanford, and in his retirement, he has been the historian on several tour ships to various parts of the world, one of them being the Antarctic. So we have spent January and February on Lopez Island, traveling in our minds with some of the most heroic adventurers in the history. So we went with Amundsen, and I forget the other...
We went with Amundsen and Scott to the pole.
And Scott, that's right. And then Shackleton last week. And we have a new story this week. Welcome, Richard. And this is a story about a voyage, not a voyage, but a exploration in search of an egg. Again, this strange and wonderful world. Richard?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. This is a story which actually nests inside of the Scott story that I told, because this story happened on the same expedition that eventually killed Scott and his two companions after they'd gotten to the South Pole and weren't able to make it back to their base camp. This is Scott writing in his diary. And by the way, I'm going to do something that I normally never do, which is to say, read a great deal from other person's writing. And the reason that I'm making that exception is that this story comes to us through the eyes of a really incredible young writer, young at the time, of course, British, by the name of Apsley George Bennett Cherry Garrard.
Oh, my gosh.
So, AGB, Cherry Garrard, it already tells you something about his lineage, a member of the British elite, usually known simply as Cherry. But to begin, let's start with something that Scott wrote. And remember, we are on that same expedition, 1911, when Scott and his two companions went to the pole and died on the way back. Here's Scott. That men should wander forth in the depth of a polar night to face the most dismal cold and the fiercest gales in darkness is something new. That they should have persisted in this effort in spite of every adversity for 5 full weeks is heroic. It makes a tale for our generation, which I hope may not be lost in the telling. Now, this voyage, if you will, and it was in one sense a voyage, this excursion, because it was on land, gave rise to perhaps the greatest of all the Antarctic books written by Apsley Cherry Garrard. It's called The Worst Journey in the World. And it's a book I highly, highly recommend to people who are interested in not just the history of Antarctic expedition, but adventure and the way in which some people have the really blessed capacity to capture in words this kind of adventure so they can pass it on to future generations. Now, who were these three men and what was their journey? Two of them are already familiar to us. The leader of the expedition, was Edward Wilson, Doc Wilson, usually called Bill or Uncle Bill. So Uncle Bill Wilson. He was just shy of 39 when the trip began. He was a recovered tubercular. He was a physician, a naturalist, a watercolorist, and he died with Scott on the journey back from the South Pole. And by the way, I have seen some of the watercolors that he did there. They've survived. They're absolutely lovely and available in various books. The second participant was Henry Robertson Bowers. He was born in 1883. He was known as Bertie Bowers. He was small of stature, about 5'4", a member of the Royal Marines. He was called Bertie because he had a rather large nose, and this was a reference to his beak. So he's called Bertie. He was very strong, tough little guy, and he also died with Scott on the return expedition from the South Pole. The third and the author of this book, Apsley George Bennett Cherry Garrard, was born in 1886, so he was just in his mid-20s at the time of this trip. He was woefully nearsighted, the proverbial blind as a bat without his glasses, which is important in this story because it's difficult to keep your glasses on and keep them clear in the weather that they encountered. He was the son of a wealthy general. He studied history and classics at Oxford, and he bought his way onto the Scott expedition. He contributed £1,000, which was a very substantial sum at that time, and he was appointed an assistant zoologist, although really he had almost no training in zoology. He'd studied history and classics at Oxford. But, of course, that study of history and classics stood him in very good stead when he came to write of this voyage. Now, why were they going on this trip? And this is a trip, by the way, which takes place, as Scott mentioned, in the early, takes place in the middle of winter. They were going on the trip because 10 years earlier, from the time of Scott's discovery voyage, Bill Wilson had nursed a scientific hope and an hypothesis. And the hypothesis was that the embryo of the emperor penguin would throw key light on the evolutionary history of birds by establishing the link between reptiles and their scales and feathers. So it was believed at that time, in the form of a hypothesis, that actually birds were the direct Darwinian descendants of reptiles, and that what started out as scales in reptiles morphed into feathers in birds. And so the idea was that if you could get an emperor egg, because the emperor is a very, very primitive bird, but with a very large egg, that if you could get one of these eggs in its embryonic stage and keep it preserved in formaldehyde or whatever, and get it back, pickled it, as they would say, that the people who knew about these things could study it, and that they could shed some light on this hypothesis. So the problem was that these eggs are laid, and the eggs are sat on and protected by the emperors in the dead of the Antarctic winter. Those of you who've seen The March of the Penguins, which is about the emperors, know that much of it was filmed in the Antarctic winter. Now, they had earlier, on the Discovery expedition at the very beginning of the century, they had brought back some eggs. The problem was that they were old eggs, and they were frozen, and they were discarded eggs from earlier. When they thawed out, they were just mush. They were just trash. Nothing we told from them. So the idea was that you had to get these eggs when they were fresh. Never let them freeze. Pickle them and bring them back. Now, Scott had doubts about this trip, but Wilson was a very important person to him. He was very fond of Wilson, and so he finally said, "Okay, Wilson, you can go. Take two companions. Be off with you." So off they went on June 27th, 1911, to march to an emperor penguin rookery, collect the eggs, bring them back, pickle them, and hopefully contribute that way to an important scientific question, or one of the questions that was seen as an important scientific question at the time. It's the dead of winter. Remember, it's June. It's 65 miles out from their base camp to the rookery, 65 miles as the crow flies, much longer by land, as we'll see. And here is Cherry writing about them setting out. Three men, one of whom at any rate is feeling a little frightened, stand panting and sweating out in McMurdo Sound. They have two sledges, one tied behind the other, and these sledges are piled high with sleeping bags, camping equipment, 6 weeks' provisions, and a case full of scientific gear for pickling and preserving the eggs. In addition, there's a pickaxe, ice axes, alpine rope, a large piece of canvas, and a bit of board. So they set out. They're pulling, each of them, 253 pounds per man on these sledges. And here is Cherry talking about why they're going. Why should three sane and common sense explorers be sledging away on a winter's night to a cape which has only been visited before in daylight, and then with very great difficulty? It's because the emperor is probably the most primitive bird in existence that the working out of his embryology is so important. And he continues, our first camp only lives in my memory because it began our education of camp work in the dark. Remember, you're far enough south, this is me talking, not Cherry, you're far enough south so that basically it's dark 24 hours a day, although there's a period of lightening of the sky, when the sky lightens at midday, but the sun never appears. But what you do get is some light from the sun below the horizon.
Okay. So would that be like comparable to a clear night with some moon or something, that kind of lightning?
Well, of course, the moon rises, so they can get, if it's not stormy, they can get some moonlight. But then that light is, I would say, not as crisp and clear as moonlight. The moonlight defines things beautifully. We've all been out on moonlit nights where you can see perfectly. I would say no, that the light they're talking about is more of a, let's say, at this time of year, I was up at 6 o'clock this morning, you could tell that it wasn't midnight. As you look to the east from our house, you could see some glow there. You could find a way around without falling down the steps, but barely that. That's the light.
Okay, that's okay. Clear. It's nice to have that image of what they're kind of stumbling through. Mm-hmm.
There were, back to Cherry. There was just enough wind to make us want to hurry. Don our harness, each man, strap on the sledge, quick with the floor cloth, the bags to hold it down, now a good spread with the bamboos and the tent inner lining. Hold them, Cherry, and over with the outer covering, snow on to the skirting, and inside the cook with his candle and box of matches. So they're making their first camp with a tent. Now later, they're getting closer to the penguins. The horror of the 19 days it took us to travel from Cape Evans, which is where they started, to Cape Crozier, which is where the penguins are, would have to be re-experienced to be appreciated, and anyone would be a fool who went again. It's not possible to describe it. The weeks which followed them were comparative bliss, not because later our conditions were better, they were far worse, but because we were callous. I, for one, had come to that point of suffering at which I didn't really care if only I could die without much pain. They talk of the heroism of the dying. They little know. It would be so easy to die. A dose of morphine, a friendly crevasse, and blissful sleep. The trouble is, the real trouble is, to go on. It was the darkness that did it. I don't believe minus 70 temperature would be bad in daylight. Not comparatively bad when you could see what you were doing. But in these days, we were never less than 4 hours from the moment when Bill cried, remember Bill is Dr. Wilson, time to get up, to the time when we got into our harness. In other words, it took them 4 hours to break camp and to get harnessed up. It took two men to get one man into his harness, and it was all they could do, for the canvas was frozen, and our clothes were frozen, until sometimes not even two men could bend them into the required shape. Overnight, everything froze solid. But in these days, we were... The trouble is sweat and breath. I never knew before how much of the body's waste comes out through the pores of the skin. On the most bitter days, when we had to camp before we had done a four-hour march in order to nurse back our frozen feet, it seemed that we must be sweating. And all this sweat, instead of passing away through the porous wool of our clothing and gradually drying off us, froze and accumulated. We passed just away from it, passed just away from our flesh, and then it became ice. When we got into our sleeping bags, if we were fortunate, we became warm enough during the night to thaw this ice. Part remained in our clothes, part passed into the skins of our sleeping bags, and both were soon sheets of armor plate. Now, going back for a moment to the beginning of the trip, they find that they can't move the sledges. It's just impossible for one man to pull the 250 pounds. So they start to make relays. And of course, a relay means that two people pull a sled. So for every 3 miles you make, you've actually gone 9 miles, out, back, and out again. We were steering by the stars. Now, Cherry has blisters, and the blisters are bothering him. They've frozen into ice. So he has ice blisters, but they thaw after dinner. And then he can drain them. And he says, sometimes it was difficult not to howl. Because he can't see without his glasses, and he can't wear his glasses, he is forever falling into crevasses. And here he is on moving by touch with his feet. Now, they're wearing something called finnesko. Finnesko is actually a skin boot. And it's tanned reindeer hide again with the hair on the outside. It's from a Norwegian word, and Amundsen and his people use that, and Scots people had learned to wear of this much better than boots. And here's Cherry again. The effect of walking in finnesko is much the same as walking in gloves. You get a sense of touch which nothing else except bare feet could give you. Thus we could feel every small variation in surface, every crust through which our feet broke, every hardened patch below the soft snow. We soon began to rely more and more upon the sound of our footsteps to tell us whether we were on crevasses or solid ground. Remember, they basically can't see well enough, so they're navigating by foot touch. From now onwards, we were working among crevasses fairly constantly. I loathe them in full daylight, when much can be done to avoid them. And when, if you fall into them, you can, at any rate, see where the sides are, which way they run, and how best to scramble out. One wondered whether your harness was going to hold when the jerk came. But those days were a Sunday school treat compared to our days of blind man's buff with the emperor penguins among the crevasses of Cape Crozier. Again, here's a little bit from Cherry about not breaking camp, but making camp and trying to get into their sleeping bags. Get out of their sleeping bags. After we got in, came 7 shivering hours, and first thing on getting out of our sleeping bags in the morning, we stuffed our personal gear into the mouth of the bag before it could freeze. This made a plug, which when removed, formed a frozen hole for us to push into as a start in the evening. Now, finally, they get to Cape Crozier, where the penguins are, and they can hear them squawking away down by the water. And here's how they planned to set up camp there in order to catch the penguins, get the eggs, and conduct their experiments, which is basically to pickle them and things. Our scheme was to build an igloo with rock walls, banked up with snow, using a 9-foot sledge as a ridge beam and a large sheet of green canvas as a roof. We bought a board to form a lintel over the door. Here with the stove, which was to be fed with blubber from the penguins, we were to make a comfortable warm home whence we could make excursions to the rookery, perhaps 4 miles away. Perhaps we would manage to get our tent down to the rookery itself and do our scientific work there on the spot, leaving our nice hut for a night or more. That's how we planned it.
Something tells me it unfolded differently.
Work off. So they set out to the emperors. Said the temperature was lowish, minus 40 degrees. It was impossible for me to wear my spectacles, and this was a tremendous difficulty to me and a handicap to the party. Bill would find a crevasse and point it out. Birdie would cross. Then time after time, in trying to step over or climb over on the sledge, I put my feet right into the middle of the cracks. This day I went well in at least 6 times, once when we were close to the sea, rolling into and out of one, then down a steep slope until brought up by Bertie and Bill with the rope. We heard the emperor's calling. We roped up and started to worry along the cliffs, which had now changed from ice to rock and rose 800 feet above us. The tumult of pressure which climbed against them showed no order here. Here you have a good example, Fagan speaking. Here you have a good example of the way in which the ice is pushed up against the cliff, and it just crunches up against it in this mad sort of jagged peaks, and makes no sense at all. Back to Cherry. 400 miles of moving ice behind it, had tossed and twisted those giant ridges of ice until Job himself would have lacked words to reproach their maker. We scrambled over and under, hanging on with our axes and cutting steps where we could not find a foothold with our crampons. Excited by now and thoroughly enjoying ourselves, we found the way ahead easier until the penguin's call reached us and we stood, three crystallized ragamuffins above the emperor's home. They were there all right, and we were going to reach them. But where were all the thousands of which we'd heard? They saw only a couple hundred. What little light there was going fast. We were much more excited about the approach of complete darkness and the look of wind in the south than we were about our triumph. After indescribable effort and hardship, we were witnessing a marvel of the natural world. We were the first and only men who had ever done so. We had within our grasp material which might prove of the utmost importance to science. We were turning theories into facts with every observation we made, and we had but a moment to give. They hurry on to the birds. Interesting as the life history of these birds must be, we'd not traveled for 3 weeks to see them sitting on their eggs. We wanted the embryos, and we wanted them as young as possible, fresh and unfrozen, so that specialists at home might cut them into microscopic sections and learn from them the previous history of birds throughout the evolutionary ages. And so Bill and Bertie rapidly collected 5 eggs, which we hoped to carry safely in our midst to our igloo, where we would pickle them in alcohol we had brought for the purpose. We also wanted oil for our blubber stove, and Bertie and Bill killed and skinned 3 birds. An emperor weighs up to 91 pounds. So they hurry back to the cliff. They climb up the cliff over this twisted ice. They have the eggs in their midst. The way up the cliff is difficult. They have to use ropes and climb, and Cherry falls, and the 2 eggs in his mitts are smashed.
No.
So there are now
only
3.
I don't think he paid enough to come on this journey.
So now there are only 3 eggs. They find their sledge none too soon. The weather's worsening. They make it to the igloo. They've been at work since 3 a.m. They light the stove. They move to the tent next to the igloo, and the next day they try to make the igloo windproof. But before they can, as Cherry says, we descend into hell. And here's his description of the hell. Remember, they've still got the 3 eggs. They've got their igloo and they've got their tent. I do not know what time it was when I woke up. It was calm, with that absolute silence which can be so soothing or so terrible as circumstances dictate. Then there came a sob of wind, and all was still again. 10 minutes, and it was blowing as though the world was having a fit of hysterics. The earth was torn to pieces. The indescribable fury and roar of it cannot be imagined. "Bill, Bill, the tent has gone," was the next I remember from Bowers shouting at us again and again through the door. Journey after journey, Bertie and I fought our way across the few yards which had separated the tent from the igloo. I've never understood why so much of our gear, which was in the tent, remained, even in the lee of the igloo. The place where the tent had been was littered with gear. When we came to reckon up afterwards, we had everything except the bottom piece of the cooker and the top of the outer cooker, but the tent was gone. To get that gear in, we fought against solid walls of black snow, which flowed past us and tried to hurl us down the slope. Once started, nothing could have stopped us. I saw Bertie knocked over once, but he clawed his way back just in time. Having passed everything we could find into Bill, we got into the igloo, started to collect things together, including our very disheveled minds. There was no doubt that we were in a devil of a mess, but we got a meal that Saturday morning, our last for a very long time as it happened. Oil being of such importance to us, we tried to use the blubber stove, but after several preliminary spasms, it came to pieces in our hands, the solder having melted. Now, they're stuck in the igloo, the tent is gone, they've managed to save most of their gear, and then the storm worsens. They wait 24 hours, getting slowly drifted in, because the snow is drifting in the igloo. The roof is slamming up and down. Remember, the roof is made of canvas. The roof starts throwing off the rocks and snow blocks, because they built the igloo. They call it an igloo, but it's not what we know as an igloo. It was built out of rocks chinked up with snow. And Cherry writes, "And then it went." The roof he's talking about. The top of the door opened in little slits, and that green canvas flapped into hundreds of little fragments in fewer seconds than it takes to read this. The uproar of it all was indescribable. Even above the savage thunder of the great wind on the mountain came the lash of the canvas as it was whipped to tiny little strips. The highest rocks which we had built into our walls fell upon us, and a sheet of drift came in. They estimate that the wind was force 11 on the Beaufort scale or higher. In other words, 80 miles an hour. He continues, "In cold temperature, with all the advantages of a tent over our heads, we were already taking more than an hour of fierce struggling and cramp to get into our sleeping bags. So frozen were they, and so long did it take us to thaw our way in. Without the tent, we were dead men. Thus impiously I set out to die, making up my mind that I was not going to try and keep warm, that it might not take too long, and thinking I would try and get some morphine in other words, for the medical case, if it got bad. Not a bit heroic and entirely true. Yes, comfortable warm reader, men do not fear death, they fear the pain of dying. And then, quite naturally, and no doubt disappointingly to those who would like to read of my last agonies, I fell asleep. I expect the temperature was pretty high during this great blizzard, and anything near zero was very high to us. That and the snow which drifted over us made a pleasant wet kind of snipe march inside our sleeping bags, and I'm sure we all dozed a good bit. There was so much to worry about that there was not the least use in worrying, and we were very, very, very tired."
They were in some sort of hibernation state,
right,
almost.
Exactly.
Much like the...
snowed in.
Yeah.
And it is the case that often when the wind comes up like that, the temperature comes up with it. As he said, zero for us was very warm. The storm is abating. He says, "We got the floor cloth wedged under our bags, then got into our bags, drew the floor cloth over our heads. Between us, we got the primus alight somehow, and by hand, we balanced the cooker on top, minus the two parts which had blown away. The flame flickered in the drafts. Very slowly, the snow in the cooker melted. We threw in a plentiful supply of pemmican," which was their basic food. Remember, it's basically... animal fat and dried meat of some kind, "and the smell of it was better than anything on earth. In time we got both tea and pemmican, which was full of hairs from our bags, penguin feathers, dirt, debris, but delicious. The blubber left in the cooker got burnt, gave the tea a burnt taste. None of us ever forgot that meal. I enjoyed it as much as such a meal could be enjoyed, and that burnt taste will always bring back the memory. So fortified, they go out to look for the tent with not high hopes." And then a miracle takes place. They actually find the tent. It is blown against something, held there by the wind. The tent was hardly damaged, And Cherry writes, our lives had been given, had been taken away and given back to us. We were so thankful that we said nothing. So now they head back. They have the tent. They have most of their gear. They're on the trail for 8 days to get back the 64 miles as the bird flies. The horrors of that return journey are blurred to my memory, and I know they're blurred to my body at the time. I think this applies to all of us, for we were much weakened and calloused. The day we got down to the penguins, I had not cared whether I fell into a crevasse or not. We'd been through a great deal since then. I know that we slept on the march, for I woke up when I bumped against Bertie, and Bertie woke when he bumped against me. I think Bill, steering out in front, managed to keep awake. I know we fell asleep if we waited in the comparatively warm tent when the promise was alight. With our pannikins, those are the little mess kits they have, or the promise in our hands. I know that our sleeping bags were so full of ice that we did not worry if we spilled water or hoosh, that's the cocktail I mixed up, the soup-like creation of pemmican and water, or spilled hoosh over them as they lay on the floor. When we cooked on them with our maimed cooker. Now, by day six, it's clear they're going to make it. And Cherry writes, as we began to gather our gear together to pack up for the last time, Bill said quietly, I want to thank you two for what you've done. I couldn't have found two better companions, and what is more, I never shall. I'm proud of that, writes Cherry. Antarctic exploration is seldom as bad as you imagine, seldom as bad as it sounds. But this journey had beggared our language. No words could express its horror. So now they approach the hut back at the base camp. We halted and stood there trying to get ourselves and one another out of our frozen harnesses, the usual long job. The door opened. Good God! Here's the Crozier party, said a voice, and disappeared. It's now August 1st, 1911, dead of winter. Mm-hmm. Inside was pandemonium. Most men had gone to bed, and I have a blurred memory of men in pajamas and dressing gowns getting hold of me and trying to get the chunks of armor, which were my clothes, to leave my body. Finally, they cut them off and threw them into an angular heap at the foot of my bed. Next morning, they were a sodden mass, weighing 24 pounds. We slept 10,000 years, were wakened to find everybody at breakfast, and passed a wonderful day lazing about, half asleep, wholly happy, listening to the news and answering the questions. So ended the worst journey in the world. Later, Cherry reminisced about this. Obviously, this was all written when he got back to England. And he writes, and we did stick it. How good the memories of those days are, with jokes about Bertie's picture hat, with songs we remembered off the gramophone, with ready words of sympathy for frost-bitten feet, with generous smiles for poor jests, with suggestions of happy beds to come. We did not forget the please and the thank you, which means much in such circumstances, and all the little links with decent civilization, which we could still keep going. I'll swear there was still a grace about us when we staggered in, and we kept our tempers, even with God. Even with God. Now, of course, his two companions, as I mentioned, perished with Scott on the way back from the pole. So we have only two more bits of this story that we have to pick up. What happened to the eggs?
Right. I was refraining from asking because I thought there was more to come, but it was on the tip of my tongue and I just didn't ask.
Okay. What happened to the eggs? Well, three actually survived in the pickled state, and the embryos were entrusted to a Cambridge don who died in 1915 before he had completed his research on the eggs. They were then passed to a professor in Edinburgh, who kept them until he died in 1933. They are now 22-year-old eggs. Still no final conclusions. Finally, in 1934, a third expert concluded that the development of the penguin embryo could not shed any new light on the problem of the evolution of birds. So, there's the eggs.
So, the purpose of the journey was the penguin eggs. That was the... But the real purpose of the journey was the journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what happened to Cherry Garrard? He went, as I had mentioned earlier, many of them did, into service in the First World War. He was an artillery officer. He came back from the journey, and particularly from the loss of his two beloved companions, a much, I would say, damaged man, psychologically damaged. He was on the party that went out to look for Scott and Wilson and Bertie Bauer, and he was there when they were found in the tent. He was invalided out of the military with chronic colitis in 1915. Since he came from a wealthy landed family, he was able, during the long, long convalescence that he had during the end and after the First World War, to write The Worst Journey in the World. As I mentioned, he never recovered psychologically from his journey, and particularly from the loss of Scott, Wilson, and Bauer. But he did live on, and in his 60s, after World War II, he wrote a final gloss on his polar adventures by way of a postscript to one of the many, many republications of The Worst Journey. And this captures, I think, the essential sadness. It's not cynicism. It's the essential sadness, the tragic nature of the world view that he developed as a result of both the polar expedition, because he never went back to Antarctica, and of the First World War, and the Second World War by then. He writes, and I'll close with this, "Our problems are not new. They're as old as the men who hunted the prehistoric hills. When they hit one another on the head with stones, the matter was confined to a few caves. Now it shakes a crowded world. Human nature doesn't change. It just becomes more dangerous. Those who guide the world now may think they're doing quite well. So perhaps did the dodo. Man, having destroyed the whales, may end up by destroying himself. The penguins may end like the prehistoric reptiles. All may follow the mammoths and the dinosaurs into fossilized oblivion." He died on May 18th, 1959, at the age of 75, mm-hmm. and left us one of the truly great books, not just of polar adventure, but of the human spirit and adventure and exploration in general.
One of the things that strikes me really strongly is how little of that kind of melancholy despair is in the book that he wrote about the journey itself, even though already he had experienced the death of his companions mm-hmm. and was transformed in terms of his perception of humanity. And yet the book he wrote about this journey, whether the core of it was about how they kept their civility and the again,
even,
my word,
even
sacredness.
With God.
Even with God, exactly. Yeah. And the, again, my word, sacredness, or the immense power, personal power, and influence this journey had on these people.
Yeah, and it's clearly, I think, when you read the book, it's a long book, but worth every page of it. I think the subtext, in addition, obviously, to just telling the story of this adventure, is it's a kind of homage, it's a kind of honoring of his two dead mm-hmm. companions, because he has no trouble poking fun of himself, none what. So ever. And he's not solemn about his companion, but it's clear that he feels that this is the finest that the empire produced. This is the best of Britain.
Right. And again, I mean, really, certainly parallel to the dignity and heroism and struggles that Shackleton had, I can see why all of these stories are can be reflected in kind of the development of leadership in our current age. I mean, they're just so moving and such lives of service to each other.
And of course, you can also, I think, sense from this how much a part of sort of the patriotic and nationalistic canon of traditional England, well, Great Britain, the islands in general, this is. I mean, this is part of their iconography and their mythology, too. And it's understandable why that should be the case.
Absolutely. God and country.
Right.
Yeah. don't
forget the Queen.
and well, thank you again, Richard. And do you have an idea what we're going to be looking at in March?
In early March. What I think I'll do, which I think hopefully people will find quite interesting, I think I'll talk about the photographic record of the Scott and the Shackleton expeditions. Obviously, I can't show pictures, but I'll try and say something about where you can see these pictures, but also how they did this quite unbelievable job in these circumstances of not only a magnificent still photographic record, but also a moving picture record, which exists from both of these expeditions in the early part of the 20th century. So the spirit is before, point, and shoot.
All right. Well, I certainly look forward to that on another, shall we say, chapter of this strange and wonderful world as we have traveled through the Antarctic with Richard Fagan. And thank you again.